You know what I think is the difference there? Because I've seen that a lot too. The ones that don't, that work hard and don't ever get there, they seem to have a couple of things working against them. One, they won't study people that are really successful. You know, so there's one, and they also seem to be a little close-minded when you give them advice.
That's true. Mm.
But the That's ones true. That are sponges, that are open-minded and like, just tell me what to do and I'll do it. Mm-hmm. And then they're also looking, and they're actively looking on Instagram at good art. And then there's the person who you ask them who their heroes are, and they show you really bad artists, and you're like, that's the problem right there too. So it's like maybe it's the aesthetic. Maybe it's the aesthetic that they're born with or not born with, that they have or don't have. Because I mean, if you like things that no one likes, that's ugly, you're gonna make ugly. You know what I mean?
I think there's a couple factors too. It's style, but it's also voice. And you may technically not be a great illustrator, but looking at your illustrations, you can see, oh, this person's trying to say something interesting, mm-hmm. something engaging, something, you know,
smart
or something like that.
Disturbing.
And that can take it 100 miles further than just the art. Hello, everybody, and welcome to 3-Point Perspective, the podcast about illustration, how to do it, how to make a living at it, and how to make an impact in the world with your art. I'm Jake Parker.
I'm Lee White.
And I'm Will Terry. And all three of us are professional illustrators. And we've all worked for all the major publishers in the business. Together, we've published, I don't know, 50 or 100 books, and we've all taught illustration at university.
Each week, we come at you guys with a different topic in illustration. Sometimes we argue, sometimes we agree, rarely, but each time you're going to learn something brand spanking new.
Great.
How many of us were fired from university? That's what I want. Because we all taught illustration at university.
That lawsuit is still pending. But now we don't. I can't talk about it.
So that means that there's a story behind each one of us and the reason why we don't still teach.
I wouldn't say I got fired. I just, my problem was they had an issue that I didn't have a degree, an art degree. Mm.
And so, that highlights how archaic the choices that universities make at this point. I feel very secure in saying that. Like they are like, it's like steering the Titanic. Like you can't turn it that well. You can't maneuver, and they get stuck in these patterns. And and that's why, I mean, my school was making just horrible choices. They overexpanded, and then they ended up having to lay off 800 people at once. But the problem was, like, I was adding classes that were essential, in my opinion, that were gaps in the education. It would take sometimes 2 years to get that class into production, into it being run. Mm-hmm. And I was ready to run it, you know, at mm-hmm. It took 2 years, and so it was
In fact, I was told 2.5 to 3 years to write a class.
Exhausting to get.
And I was asked to write a class, and I turned them down because who knows what they're going to be doing in 2.5 years from now.
Why so long? Like, what's the holdup?
It's just getting it into, so many approvals has to be done.
Well,
and then the other thing that I noticed, I'm going to throw some university people under the bus right now. Now, a lot of people had stopped. Let's get the year off right.
Spill the tea.
they had stopped working years and years ago because it's really hard to teach full time and to stay a full time illustrator. You almost can't do it. And so a lot of the full time faculty just did not have current work that they were doing, current illustration jobs. They were, you know, a decade out.
Right. It's like, when was the last time you actually talked to an art director or an editor, you know, had an interaction with them? And and if it hasn't been, you know, 6 months or a year, then you're outdated, you know? You're already, like, that's the way things
are. I would say the same reason, though, the same types of things have happened to us at SBS in that, now, I've got you guys' attention now.
What?
And when I say you guys, I mean Jake and Lee. They're like, oh, what are you about to...
Where's he going?
From when we first started, mm-hmm. I mean, we thought of a class and we made it in a matter of weeks. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. They just did
Correct.
It.
Yeah.
Now we have, you know, people that we work with. Mm-hmm. It's not just us. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of things to consider. There's a lot of meetings to, we try to double check and make sure that we're doing, making smart moves and not dumb moves. And so things just take us longer. Our process is a lot longer now from start to finish.
That's
no, nowhere near as long as the university, but
yeah, it won't take us 3 years to get a class up and running. More like
two and a half years.
Yeah. Two and a half years. No, that's a good point. The more people you bring into an organization, just the more communication that needs to happen, the more back and forth. And when you get to this university level where there's, you know, there's a faculty, and then above them there's administration, and above them there's, you know,
there's the accreditation board too. You know,
yeah, there's all this stuff. It's hard and it's crazy.
I tell you the one thing sometimes. That we would never do though, that the university system does, and that is hire, like, you got a full-time person and all of a sudden a class needs teaching that they couldn't get an adjunct for, they just throw the full-time person in there. It does not matter what the subject is. It could be graphic design. It could be anything. And mm-hmm. That person may or may not have any experience in that subject. We would never do that.
Yeah. Can I ask you guys a question?
No.
Professional question.
Professional question.
I was going to ask you before we started, but then I thought, no, this would be a good podcast discussion. Then we'll get to the questions we received from our SVS members. But okay. My question.
Before you do that, can I throw something in?
Yeah.
My background, if you're watching on YouTube, looks dumb right now. And I just thought that you guys should know why. Because I've moved, but I'm not in my new house and studio yet.
That's a good point. So if you're watching this podcast on YouTube, you'll notice that Will looks like he's in a laundry room.
He's got an iron next to you. I didn't notice that iron next to your head.
There's an iron. Yeah, it's like right here.
He's staying with the in-laws.
Right there. Is it like a mop or something?
Oh, wow, you couldn't just move that for the recording?
For the podcast? It's fine. Adds to the ambiance.
It's raw. It's raw and it's authentic.
Will is on the run, and this gives the impression could be anywhere, like an outlaw.
Will actually lives in Arizona now with me.
That's
he's
right.
About an hour from where I live, which is kind of cool. That's we right. got to see each other in person the other day. Anyway, yeah, here's my question.
Okay.
I have an online shop. I've been running an online shop I've been selling things online with PayPal since like 2004, I think. So a long time. And that's grown over the years. Eventually I got a big cartel shop. And we talked a lot about, if you're curious about online shops, go to our episode on how to start an online shop. But this year I've been running a Shopify shop, and every year I put in a new book or a couple new prints, but really it hasn't been a focus of mine. It's always been like a side hustle, right? But this year I want to actually make products, invest some time and some money into making products for the shop and focus on it and have it be like build it out and have it be a good revenue source, but also a good creative outlet for me. So here's my question, and it has to do with social media. I see online, I've been following a bunch of people who primarily run online shops for their art, and that's like their main gig. They're not taking on freelance work. They're just making product for their online shops. Mm-hmm. And all of their Instagram accounts are devoted solely to like that online shop. And sometimes they'll show like, here's artwork I'm developing, which will then become a pin or a print or, you know, a keychain or whatever it is. Mm-hmm. But it's primarily an Instagram account devoted to shop. So I have an Instagram account. It's got 500,000 followers. I don't know how many of them are robots and how many are actual
give or people. Take a few hundred thousand.
Probably. Anyways, my question is, do I fill my feed with shop stuff, you know, in between all of my drawing updates and posts on artwork and things like that? Or do I make a separate Instagram account just for my shop, which is focused directly on everything that's going into the shop, like exclusive things that you know might only be available on that Instagram account? My reason being, my thinking is, it immediately divides people who are just casual fan on my main account with people who are actual, like, what would you call it? Like a more devoted fan who actually want to buy something. It would give them make me see that who the actual, I guess, true fans are versus who are people who just casually want to see what's going on and what I'm posting. Does that make sense? Does it make sense to build out a brand identity for the shop?
I don't think so.
Or just keep it all in one thing?
I'd keep it all in one thing. I think what you're going to do is start to muddy the water. People will be confused by the difference, and they think they might miss out if they don't see the right feed from the right account. I think anytime you can stay simple is always better, in my opinion. And it's not going to be, now you're having to post to two different accounts, and there's going to be some stuff that's going to be like, okay, which one do I do? Then do you double the post? I just see it getting away from you.
Yeah. If you were going to make artwork that was a total departure, like if Jake Parker landscapes, you know, oil landscapes, plein air painting.
Right.
Yeah. Different Instagram. But like, you know, I'm putting myself in the shoes of the average Jake Parker fan, and I want to know everything that you're into. I want to see it all because I'm interested in you. You're an interesting person.
This harebrained idea was, I follow a guy named Levi Pruitt, and his online handle is Levito. And he has a separate Instagram account. I think his main account has like 200,000 followers, but he has a separate Instagram account called Club Levito. And essentially, he uses that account to post like original artwork that he's selling. And so if you want like first dibs or know when something drops in his shop, people follow that account. So, and maybe have notifications on it so that they know when something new is, versus his main feed, his main account is just essentially posting artwork, posting, you know, little updates here and there on what he's working on, things like that. Whereas that account is, here's something new in the shop. They can easily scroll through and see, oh, he's got a print for sale here. He's got artwork for sale here. And I see that account. But
wouldn't that be link in bio kind of thing? I mean, wouldn't people do that anyway? Like, oh, I like this one thing he just posted. Maybe there's more. And then you go to the links. I don't know. If people can't figure that out, I don't know how. I don't know.
Okay. So then the option would be keep it all on the same account and just have my feed be posting a lot more about, here's what's in the shop, here's my new products. You know, maybe every day, every other day is like some sort of promotional thing for the shop, whereas it's not just posting artwork or posting sketches or things that I'm working on. But there's a balance between stuff I'm working on and pitching or
I love selling. That, because then that gives you more content anyway. And it gives you a variety of content. It's not the same thing.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. I guess part of me is I just want a way to have, so the big issue is the algorithm, right? So if you're following, say you're following 100 people, okay? Or I don't know, we'll just say 100 people. You go onto Instagram, Instagram's going to pick who, out of those 100 people who have posted recently, who have had somewhat engagement, and you're going to scroll through and you're only going to see a post of 25 of those people, right? Before you get through all of them. So my question is, if there's a separate account devoted just to people interested in new drops in the shop, there's a higher, my thinking is there's a higher chance of that showing up in their feed as well because there's two chances that they're getting hit with that algorithm mix up of there's a regular account, there's a second account. Does that make sense?
Yeah, you're just saying more frequency. If there's two posts, then now you have twice as much chance of ending up in somebody's feed.
Yeah. And I'm wondering if I'm wondering how the algorithm works if there's a lot of engagement relative to the size of that account. So let's say the account has 1,000 followers, the shop does, but those people are more engaged percentage wise, you know, instead of 1,000 people engaged on my 500,000 account, there's 100 people engaged on my, 1,000 follower account. That's a higher percentage of people engaged. Will that algorithm see this as higher engagement and put it in the feed, you know, make it show up more likely in the feed, right?
But then also, what if you're posting from the same phone? Does Instagram look at that and ding you at all because they're like, well, he's got two accounts.
Yeah, you're overposting or something like that.
I just wonder. Well, I don't know.
I mean, I have the Inktober account and my Instagram, my Jake Parker account, and I have Inktober, Jake Parker, my friends call me Jake, and Jake Parker Tools. I started an account just listed all my tools this is back when everybody was asking, what tool is that? I just made an account that said Jake Parker Tools, and I put 20 photos on there of everything that I use, and then people would say, well, what tool? And I'd say, go to this account. It was just an easy way for them to look through and see everything.
How many followers does that have?
Let me check really quick.
If your tools has more followers than I have, I'm going to be mad.
How many followers do you have? You had like 20,000 right now.
Yeah, something.
Right?
It's slow. Jake it's a Parker. Slow build. I think you got in the snowball days where it was building, you know, daily. It's a lot harder now, I think.
I have over 9,000
That's followers. Not bad for your tools.
And the last post was in 2018. So, I don't know, 27 posts. That's what I'm thinking. Like, maybe the shop has its own account and it's just, you go on there and you can see, oh, there's a book for sale. Oh, there's a print for sale. Oh, and you don't have to like scroll through everything.
Why don't you try it and see, try it and report back and see how it is. I guess the take home for everybody who are now thinking about turning the channel because we're really boring right now is the take home is, we still don't understand how to exactly use this stuff. And these are discussions we still have. Even somebody like Jake Parker, who has 500,000 followers, you'd think that we have it all figured out, but we don't. I mean, it's still a question.
I will say this. I've been listening while I'm working. I just typed in how to grow your Instagram following on YouTube. I've just been listening to every fake guru or real guru, whatever, just say like, here's how you grow it in 2020. Here's how you grow it in 2021. Here's what you do. And my big takeaway from all of them is, and this was an aha moment for me, is your Instagram account is not a portfolio. What it is a conversation tool. And as soon as you start treating it like a conversation tool, you'll get more followers, you'll get more engagement, and the algorithm will favor you more. And you have to just understand that your average person isn't going to Instagram to look at people's portfolios. They're looking to have some sort of, to be a part of a conversation and see what's going on and what's new.
What's an example of a conversation versus a portfolio post?
So maybe you post artwork because you just finished something and say you did a drawing of, a kid at a carnival and he's got a balloon, right? You did that one with the Totoro balloon, right?
Generic character that did not get a cease and desist.
Fuzzy character. So let's say you post that on there. Your first line in your comment might, or in your first line might be under the description of the photo. What was the last carnival you went to? Immediately, that person instead is going to say, nice drawing of a kid at a carnival. They're going to be like, oh yeah, I went to the Texas State Fair. Man, that was so fun. They're going to fill it out. And pretty soon there's a conversation happening in your thing. So one easy thing is just ask a question in your post. The other thing I did the other day was, I was did a story of me drawing. I took a video of me drawing, and then I put on there, what are you drawing today? And I got like a, I didn't count them, but I was scrolling for like a minute when I got all these responses. It was maybe 500 responses. It was so many. Wow. People just telling me what they were drawing. And I reposted some of them, as many as I had time to repost, so that people could see, like, here's what other people are drawing. But it's just people wanting to, like, be a part of this conversation that's happening. And what was interesting is because that boosted engagement in the stories, my next post on my feed actually had a higher amount of engagement, likes, comments than the previous posts I had been doing. Mm. So
cool.
It all, I mean, right now I'm just devoting a little more, I've sort of neglected social media. Like, I've just given it the attention it barely needed to survive, like, for the past couple of years. And now I'm like, well, let's see what happens if I actually do a little homework, try a few tactics and things, and see if it, like, moves the needle at all in this stuff. So it's interesting.
Cool.
All right. So thanks, guys, for letting me bounce that off of you. I figured if I'm wondering and dealing with something, somebody else out there might be, and they might.
What are you going to do? You already know what you're going to do.
I already know that you guys are wrong.
You're going to create an Instagram account. We all already knew it.
You're looking for validation on the thing you already decided to do.
Yeah. All right. Will, I believe we have... I'm just changing subjects unless there's more you wanted to razz me.
Well, on. I just want to let everyone know that I'll say the thing that you're thinking. Whenever Jake's speaking, I'll just.
I guess okay, more yeah, so, have... I did want validation on that idea, but I also just, like, I really did want to hear, like, someone say, no, that's a bad idea, and give me a reason why, you know? Because when you go down a path, you're like, this is great. At least for me, like, it's hard for me to see the other side of it. Like, why would you waste time doing that? You know? So you guys helped it. I don't like how you're handling that knife, Lee, right in front of me.
I will be bloody by the time this podcast ends. I'm going to flip this blade up and it's going to cut me. I mean, I fidget with stuff while we're doing podcasts all the time. It probably shouldn't be like a switchblade. he's got a knife too.
This is the ADD podcast today.
This is my box.
All right, so we do have a few questions that we wanted to answer.
Let's get to these.
Let's quit messing around.
So this one's from Asya, and I'll just go ahead and read it.
Okay,
let's do it.
You guys can answer it. Am I mentally ready to take on a project? With all that's been going on in life, I still want nothing more than to be published as an author illustrator. That being said, my life is so busy with three kids at home, with me at home, things to take care of. How could I possibly be ready to take on a project, especially for a first project? I don't think I'm mentally ready, but my heart wants this so bad. And immediately when I read this, I thought, well, are the three of us the most qualified to answer this question? You know, I never personally had three kids at home at the same time. My wife took care of the kids, but then she did go to school when our third kid was a baby, and I had to take care of the baby. So I do have a little bit of experience with this. You know, she was school teacher at junior high, and I had this little baby in a bassinet that I put under right beside my desk while I drew. I didn't have two other kids running around. Yeah. But I didn't, but I can't really imagine, because he would sleep, my youngest Seth, you know, he'd fall asleep and I'd just start cranking and getting work done. Mm-hmm. You know, and I tried to stay off the phone, but that's when I would plan on doing a lot of my drawings or paintings for illustration projects. But I didn't have two other kids coming in and waking up the baby, you know, and so I did have time, and I know that that's way easier than three kids at home. What do you guys think?
I will say this. I've been working at home for the past 10 years now. And so I've watched firsthand my wife doing like kid stuff and me, you know, pausing to help out from time to time or just being flexible with my work. And man, kids at home is a full-time job. It's like, it is hard to get anything done other than kid stuff, especially when they're before they go to school. As soon as they go to school, that does free up some time, but then you're on the hook as soon as they're home from school, right? And before school starts. So she says, my life is so busy with three kids at home and with me at home to take care of things. I think, and in talking with like our friend Sarah Jane, who's a stay-at-home mom, who also is an illustrator, talking with Tani, who's one of our SVS teachers, mm-hmm. who also stay-at-home mom with kids. Her kids are a little bit older now. I look at these women who juggle these things, and I'm super impressed because they're doing so much, and they're good at it. They're good at like balancing it. But I want to say, it gets a little bit better once those kids go to school. So it might be that you carve out, you I guess set your expectations for the amount of time that you have right now. Mm-hmm. you lower those, like the expectations for what you can get done, and say, if I am able to get a half an hour today on a project or an hour today on a project, then that's a good thing. You know, if you have a partner that you're living with that's helping you, a spouse or whatever, and you tell them, this is something that means a lot to me and I really want to do, then it might be something to work it out with them that they take the kids at some point during the day, or that you're able to hire some sort of help to take the kids at some point during the day so that you do get a good solid chunk of time to work on something. That's how I've seen women do it in the past, or currently that I know personally. And then I think once you're opened up a little bit with the freedom of kids going to school and there's more time in the day, then you can expand a little bit more and you could spend more time on a project. But I think the short of it is it's just hard, and these frustrations that you're feeling are legitimate, and I think you have to figure out a way to work within those limitations.
I'll add to that if you use the kids going to school as the point where you can start doing full projects and work backwards from that, it's a slow burn, I think, to get into this industry. It's not just like, oh, I think I'll take a project and now I have a project. You know, it's I think I want to start taking on projects. Now I got to find a client list. Now I got to build my portfolio up. And all that stuff can take place over a long, much longer period and a very slow burn, because it's not so immediate that deadlines are a part of it and all that. And so I would use the time where the kids are at home to set up these slower deadlines that eventually work out in terms of timing to when the kids are in school. And then now you have a client list. Now you have advertising budget. Now you have a bunch of portfolio pieces that you know you want to advertise. And then you just hit the ground running. And that's when the real projects will start to take place, where deadlines become a little more crucial.
Mm-hmm. And I know of, just talking with my friends of mine who have done this balancing thing, there's also ways to you could carve out early morning hours or late night hours where you want to get a few hours chunked together. It might be that you rearrange a schedule so that when kids are asleep or when your partner's home from work, that they can take care of these kids a couple of nights a week or a couple of mornings of the week, get them off to school and just kind of work out a situation with your partner. If you're, you know, a single mom with kids, again, that's that's so hard. I don't know. Mm-hmm. I don't know how you would. There's the saying that there's just a time and a season for everything in life, and it might be that this is just your research and development phase until freedom.
That's what I was saying. Know. Like build up a good Pinterest account, references, all that kind of stuff that you can do when you're, you know, to do a children's book, you need all your mental energy to be fresh. And that's just not possible with the kids. You know, it's funny because you forget what it's like as your kid starts to get a little bit older. My kid's 10 now. Not that I'm out of the woods by any stretch, but it's easier than when he was, you know, little. But I just went on vacation for a week with my brother, and he's got a 1-year-old and a 2-year-old. And it was a disaster. We couldn't do anything. Like it was all dictated by the babies, the whole schedule, what we ate, how everything went was dictated by them. And I had forgotten how dominant that is at that stage of life.
Another thing to think of is I don't know anyone who has a thriving illustration career who didn't go through a lot of struggle. Either financially or trying to find time because they're working a full-time job and trying to make the transition over to the thing that they really want to do, which is illustration. I can't think of anybody who, you know, had either a spouse working or came from a very wealthy family that supported them to where they just had free time to just create all day and magically kind of develop this career. In fact, the opposite. I know people in that situation who play video games with the time. So if you catch yourself in a situation going, I could be successful if I had it like so-and-so, just know that that's not always true. In other words, I think that I would almost give a higher percentage chance of success to the person who really has to struggle to find the time to become an illustrator rather than the person that has all the time and money in the world. Because in my experience, those guys don't pan out.
That's a good point.
You bring up a really good point too. I'm thinking of the people I know who are really successful, either A, never had kids, and so they just had all this like time to devote to their craft, or they had a spouse who kind of took care of day-to-day tasks and things like that. So they had a good chunk of time every day to work on their thing. One of my favorite illustrators and friend of mine, William Joyce, who's done, you know, countless children's books, movies based off of his books, TV shows, Roly Poly Oly, Meet the Robinsons, Rise of the Guardians, all those things. His career actually started out, his wife had a job and she worked and supported him while he tried to get this children's book thing off the ground and running. And eventually when his project started to actually make money and bring in money, she quit her job and they started a family. And that's how they did it. It wasn't like, you know, he just, you know, popped out of art school and boom, had a full-blown career. There was that stage of struggle. So, you know, and I totally identify with your heart wanting something so bad, but not being in a physical place to be able to handle it, a mental place to be able to handle it. It's just, you just have to sort of wait that out and leverage certain things that you have in your life so that you can get to that point. And eventually it'll come. But I agree with Will. Yeah. In a nutshell, like there's a real struggle and every successful person I know has had to go through something like that. Okay. What's the next
question? All right.
So we got another one here. Before we go to the next question, some people might be wondering, how do I submit questions? I mean, we want questions from you guys as we're dedicating this whole year to answering questions. So where do they do that?
You're going to go to svslearn.com. You're going to click on podcast right up at the top. There's a bar there. Or if you're on your phone, click the little 3-line thing that opens up. And when you click on podcast, over on the right-hand side or somewhere on that page is going to be a little link to ask a question. And it'll just take you to a page. You fill out the form. You type in your question. It gets sent to us. That question comes right into a spreadsheet that we have so we can keep track of all these questions and what order they come in. And then we're just chipping away at them on this podcast.
Cool. I might submit a question now. Now that I know how to do it,
I should have submitted my question. We started today.
This is a new mechanism, though, that Jake built. Right, this is your handiwork, the little form and all that.
Yep.
We'll see. You guys test it to see if we can break it.
Yeah.
Okay. This one's from Krish. Does my point on the map affect my art? And I would say, does my location on the map? So as a young illustrator from India, I wanted to know about the different ways that a geographical location could affect the livelihood, creativity, and general well-being of an illustrator. In a technologically connected world, does geographical location even matter? Can an illustrator work comfortably in an industry far away from where they live? Does the area around me affect my success as an artist positively or negatively? Love to hear your thoughts about this. So I did not know the answer to this question. So I emailed this question out to a few of my art directors and an editor and got some responses back. So if you want to bear with me, I'll just read these because I can't really paraphrase them very well because they're pretty detailed. But I think it's neat that if I were asked this question, it's pretty cool to hear from actual editors in the business. So
so
this first one is from Jan Girardi. She's an editor, art director that I worked with, actually an art director that I worked with many years ago on my Pizza Pat book for Random House. Random House? Yeah, Random House. And she says, sure, I would say to Krish and any other illustrator that has this question that with the digital technology we have today, I feel that your geographic location is not a big concern when being considered for a project with a U.S. publisher. I've worked with illustrators from many countries around the world just as easily as with local artists. Digital art is easy to share. And even if your art is not digital, original reflective art can be mailed internationally to the publisher for scanning. And of course, all communication is handled through email, no matter where you live. While you can create art from anywhere, it's still important to be aware of what's currently selling in the children's book market in the country you want to be originally published in. Also, classes like how to perfect your children's book portfolio on SVS Learn are helpful for learning what you should include in your portfolio when looking to get work in your children's books. I think that was my class, guys, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm.
I'm pretty sure. To Krish's question, yes, your point on the map may affect your art, but most likely positively. Publishers need your illustrative voice. So yes, it can be a benefit by bringing something unique to your artwork that editors and art directors are looking for. And yes, it's totally fine to be far away. The digital world is small, keep working on your great art and bringing your own viewpoint to your illustrations, no matter where you live. So that's from Jan. This next one is from Nicole, who was my, Nicole Gassengay, who was my art director for the Bonaparte books at Penguin Random House. She says, I would say that geographical location doesn't matter at all anymore. It's all about how strong your portfolio is. I would even say that it's also easier now with technology being so ubiquitous to get noticed by an art director without having an agent representing you. So that was surprising to me. She thinks it's actually easier if you don't have an agent. Having your work on Instagram, Behance, Pinterest, etc., we're always looking, even if you aren't looking for us. I'm assuming your podcast listeners talking about freelance illustration, but I think we're right now on the cusp of another big change since a lot of people are working from home because of the pandemic. It's been proven that we don't all need to be in the same building in order to keep making books. I expect that staff jobs like mine as an art director and designer will start to open up to the most qualified candidate for the job, even if they aren't local to the area of the business. And then one last one from Raquel Sosa, Houghton Mifflin. The only thing I would say is cultural differences sometimes come through in artwork. A kitchen in India might look different than a kitchen in the US, et cetera. I deal with this a lot as I work with Indian artists. Other than that, I don't think location matters in the modern days of the internet, as long as schedules are followed. And that's from Raquel Sosa. So, a lot of good stuff there.
Yeah.
I would like say that Will went over our head this time. He's like, these guys can't answer this question.
Yeah. I'm like, I'm pulling it up on you.
Well, I would say, Will, like, Utah is no more remote than India, as you know, concerning New York publishers. Mm-hmm. You know, if you're not in the city, it doesn't matter if you're 1,000 miles away or halfway around the world. So I think ultimately, anybody curious about this, because I've thought this too, you know, I used to live on the East Coast. I used to live a train ride away from, you know, downtown Manhattan. And it was like, you know, an hour ride. And so I'd go down to the city and have meetings and stuff. And it was really good. And it was good to like kind of get my foot in the door, but it wasn't necessary. As long as you have, you know, really before I ever got my foot in the door, I had an agent contact me because they saw my work being posted online and said, hey, I'd like to represent you. And she lived just outside the city and was in the city, you know, every day. And so if you want to work in New York publishing, it's good to have some sort of representative there who's, you know, an agent or something like that. But again, not necessary this day and age. If you have a very strong portfolio, if your work speaks for itself, if you're professional and you're easy to get along with and you deliver work on time, you're going to have no problem building a career, living anywhere on this planet. So I think that's just a huge, I think, blessing of technology right now, is that it allows for that.
What would you guys say about the idea of having a portfolio that looks like it would fit a US audience or maybe a European audience, as far as like subject matter goes?
It's definitely going to play into how you get hired. I mean, mm-hmm. it's held me back actually sometimes because I get, I've had some art directors and editors say that the work looks like it's made for Europe. And then I don't get it here. I don't know if that means I need to make it a little more commercial or would it make the houses look more, whatever. But I did want to add a point before we move too far forward. It depends on what you're going into. If you are, I mean, I realize that we have a wide range of jobs that our listeners can fall into. And publishing, Jake and Will are totally right. And those editors are kind of leaning that way, that it's really open. I think if you're going to go into concept design or other kind of production job for entertainment, you actually do need to be, or it's very helpful to be in those locations just because you happen to meet a lot of people just randomly, like at a figure drawing workshop, you'd sit next to somebody who's already working at DreamWorks. And then these relationships start to be forged. And that becomes a little more important in that context.
Yeah. Yeah. If you're going to work in animation or video games in production, it really helps to be where those places are, because I will say though, 2020 kind of threw everyone for a curveball. And so I know people who work in animation, like I have a friend who moved from New York to get a job in LA at an animation studio, but he stopped in Utah because that's where his family lives. And he's like, there's no office for me to go into. It's closed. So there's no point for me to actually go get a place in LA. So I'm just going to live here where it's cheap until I absolutely have to like move over there. But that said, I think when everything starts going back online, and I've heard a lot of these studios are like, we're not even going to say we're opening our doors until August of 2021, right? It may be longer. It depends. But when they do open their doors, they've got so used to working with teams at home and Zoom meetings. It's and with traffic being what it is in Los Angeles and in these other big cities, it might be that everybody commutes, you know, 2 days a week instead of 5 days a week. And so there's ways around actually having to live right where it is. One thing I was going to say before we got on that thing, as far as portfolio, the number one rule of a portfolio is the portfolio matches the job that you're going to get, that you're going to get offered and that you're going to get. So if you want a particular kind of work, make the portfolio that looks like that kind of work. And that's, it's as simple as that. If you want a job in animation, make an animation portfolio. If you want a job in publishing, make a publishing portfolio. And people, even myself, you think, oh, I need to show a broad range of here's what, you know, here's everything that I can do. And in, you know, there's very few jobs where they're looking for a generalist these days, someone who can do children's booky style, but can also do like Warcraft, you know, at the same time. You're just not going to find someone, you're not going to find a job where they specifically need that. And so the more focused and more niche and specific that you can get in your portfolio, the more likely you'll be able to land a job getting that thing. And then once you've got that job, you've got a little more freedom. Then you can spend some time exploring. You can push the boundaries in the job that you're having and break out a little bit.
Yeah. I mean, we're truly living in a global marketplace right now. It's a unique time to be alive. I mean, I've got a camper. I could go off into the wilderness and illustrate. And as long as I find an internet connection, I can send artwork. I can get emails and work.
Do you guys do any work for foreign clients?
I'm currently doing a job for a French company right now. What's really cool about that is France is 8 hours ahead of us. So when I wake up in the morning, I'm getting notes at the end of their day. And so then I'll work on it all day and I'll send it at the end of my day. And so when so in their eyes, you know, it's 5 o'clock, 6 o'clock their time, PM, they send notes to me, they go home, they come back to work the next morning and they've got all this work done because I've spent a whole day working on it while they've been asleep.
That's,
you know,
awesome. That's perfect.
Yeah. Okay.
All right.
Time for one more.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Let's do one more. This one says, 39-year-old male seeking a career change. I'm 39 years old, married with 3 kids. I want to change everything, or I want to change eventually my careers and become a children's book illustrator. I have 3 questions. Number one.
Slipping in 3 questions.
Wow.
Yeah, this is a loophole here. Your form obviously didn't exclude this.
What you're saying, this. Will pigs get fat, hogs get slaughtered? Yeah. I'm surprised you didn't cut this guy before you.
What is your advice to someone who is middle-aged and would like to put their foot in the door to some publisher? 2, is it harder for older people to get work? 3, do you know of people that have changed their careers to become illustrators later in life? And he throws in, I love the podcast, you guys, and thanks for letting me slide 3 questions in there. I added that last part.
Can I start with the, is it harder for older people to get work?
Yeah.
I want to add the one thing that, you know, after teaching so many years, seeing so many different students and age ranges, the one problem that I see that older people have, and this is inherent, you got to watch out for it, I think, is as people, I think, grow up, especially those late teen, early 20 years, those tend to brand the way that you think. And I've seen this over and over with different generations. It really does brand how you think. And so as somebody gets older, say they come to a field like illustration, what their version of illustration is can sometimes be dated based on that time frame where they grew up and it had a different look to it. And so that's something that it takes some serious soul searching and good portfolio reviews to get you through that. Make sure that you're not falling in that trap. Not that you want to follow the trendy, oh, what's the, you know, what current character design, I got to make that kind of character. But you just got to watch out that the work doesn't look dated from the way it looked when you were growing up.
I agree. Another thing that I would say, though, along that line of age is most of the people that I know that really hit their stride in children's publishing or in book cover design, book cover illustration, did it in their 30s and 40s, not in their 20s.
True.
I would say. Mm-hmm. So, and I think there's a level of intelligence, or maybe not intelligence, maybe it's wisdom, that you need when you're tackling a story to be able to go macro to micro and to say, this is the information I need to convey to the viewer, not all this other stuff over here that's not important. You know, to be able to edit and to be able to not, what's that saying? Not see the forest for the trees, kind of a thing. You know, beginning illustrators, in my experience and myself included, when I was younger, we tend to just get so enamored that we can make something look realistic, or that we can make an object look cool, that we just overdo all the unimportant stuff. Mm-hmm. And one thing I see with maturing portfolios is the economy of detail and the focus, right, on the more important main idea. Now, that being said, maybe if you start at age 30, it still takes you the same amount of time to go through. I don't know. Do older people go through that quicker? Can they use the wisdom in life? You know, like right now I'm switching over from racquetball to tennis, and I have a guy that's teaching me tennis. And, you know, I've played racquetball for 35 years, and all the same, you know, he's trying to say, you know, I'm trying to hit it pretty hard. And he's saying, okay, placement, I want you to really work on your placement, slow it way down. As he's saying that, I'm like, this is the exact same thing I've taught people in racquetball, is, you know, they get in there and start blasting away. And I'm like, I'm falling into the same mistakes that begin, you know? And so I'm like, okay, Will, just apply everything, because it's all the same stuff. And I'm wondering if, you know, if your age and experience in other areas could apply and speed up the learning curve.
Probably.
In illustration.
I want to say too, just with that, add on top of that, the age factor, you have so much more experience, which you can bring to your illustrations. You're probably a much better student now than you've been in the past, because you have, more patience, you have a better understanding of a timeline, how long it takes to learn something. So I think that a 39-year-old, if they wanted to become a children's book illustrator, a professional, you know, get their first children's book job in a couple of years, I think that's completely reasonable. For it to be a full-time career, maybe a couple more years after that, as long as, like Lee said, they're able to have a good contemporary style, a style that people, you know, want to pay for, want to see. But also that they're just a little bit savvy about, I think, cutting through all the noise. There's so much that you can learn online. There's YouTube videos. There's all these online courses offering every single thing. But if you can figure out a curriculum for yourself where I need to learn this, then I need to learn that, then I need to learn that, you'll get yourself in a place where you can learn what you need to know in order to become that professional. As for examples of people who I know who have come to illustration later in life, I want you to look up Anthony Wheeler. His website's Anthony Wheeler Art. And I met him at a Comic-Con several years ago. And we talked, he pulled me aside. He's like, you know, will you look at my portfolio? And he was in his 30s when we met. He might be 40 now, I'm not sure. But he's like, hey, I want to shift careers. I want to get into illustration. I want to do this sort of thing. And so I helped him a little bit. I mean, he did most of this on his own, but I hope that I guided him, pointed him in the right direction. And I just watched him go at it with posting on social media. He wasn't afraid to post, you know, his early stuff. He was always sharing, here's what I'm working on next. He was always pushing himself as far as style and subject matter and taking on new pieces. And he recently got his first children's book job offer, right, to illustrate. And so like, I'm just so amazed that he went from completely not having any career as an artist to working in that field and being a professional. So it can be done. I've seen it. Mm-hmm. And if you follow this guy and check out his Instagram and just do a little research, and you could probably follow in his timeline, you see the story that he tells as he gets to that point. He also, I remember when he got his first table at a Comic-Con and was selling stuff. It's just really cool to see this guy kind of grow and learn that way. So
it's cool to hear that contemporary and current version. And then I was also thinking about it too, like when we go to a museum and there's the classic artists of the Renaissance and all the way up mm-hmm. to the modern artists, all those people, pretty much what you're looking at is their late stage work.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Yep. Degas, Picasso, even Chuck Close, like realistic painter. All that stuff is the late, what you think of as being, kind of the hallmark of those styles, is all later in life, like, 50s, 60s, 70s.
Mm-hmm.
So, and that's what we pay to see. That's like the best of all time. So of course you can do it.
Yeah.
Well, let me add a little caveat to this, because I think there's, this is a general question. Is it too late in life for me? And I think there's another factor in there, and that is, there's the person who at 39 has never drawn anything in their whole life. And they just, at 39, they just decide, I want to be a children's book illustrator. I want to be an illustrator. And then there's a person who's been drawing on and off and doing artistic things and creating things, maybe not even drawing, but creative endeavors their whole life, who then says, I want to be an illustrator. I think they're two totally different people. When I was teaching at UBU, we had a model in the figure drawing class, and she was in her early 20s, and she modeled for a couple of years, and then as a senior decided to switch from a computer major to illustration, and she had never drawn anything before, and they really shouldn't have let her in our classes. She showed up in one of my illustration classes, and she was so far behind that I've lost track. I don't know where she is now. Maybe she's listening and maybe she's doing great, but she was years and years and years behind and really didn't have any business being in there other than she was kind of a friend to the program because everybody knew her. And so they kind of let her in. That's anecdotal, and maybe there are some people that can have never drawn anything and develop a passion. My theory is that the person that my question to her is, why have you never drawn before? It's because you don't like drawing. You've had access to drawing your whole life, and now you decide to draw overnight. Now, let me give you another anecdote, is me and drumming. I've drummed my whole life with pencils. My parents wouldn't let me have a drum set. I wanted drums from the time I knew what drums were, and they were great. They gave me a cello instead. So I played music, but I never played the drums. Then me and my boys started, my oldest son started playing guitar. So because I played the cello and had a background in the bass clef, I got a bass. And then we were always looking for a drummer. So finally I'm like, I'm just going to buy some drums. So I bought some drums, hoping one of my other kids would play them. They didn't. So then we all started taking turns on the drums, and I'm actually pretty good now. I can play a kit now to a lot of rock songs, and I'm better than Lee. And that's the most important thing about that.
That's probably true.
But
that's probably true.
You weren't supposed to lay over like that. But anyway, the thing is, I picked it up so quickly because I've always loved drumming. Yeah. And I've always drummed, and I've always been told by teachers, stop drumming, So if you've been drawing your whole life, doodling this, doodling that, and you want to become an illustrator, I think that there's a certain amount of pencil mileage and spatial relationship training of your brain that you do over long periods of time that I don't know if you can just cram.
I am the case study. I know.
I was hoping you would talk to speak to that, actually.
Yeah, I didn't draw at all until I was 30 years old. I mean, not a single painting, not a single drawing ever. I mean, really, ever. Seriously.
So then it really comes down to the individual then. I mean, it can't be answered point blank. I mean,
yeah, there's going to be your whole history. I mean, the older you get, the more, like you were saying, Will, there's just a history there. And I did have some creative stuff that I think now looking back on it did influence how I create art. And yeah, it just was a different kind of art or whatever. But
yeah,
it's an interesting topic.
Yeah. Yeah.
I would say for this guy, it really comes down to how bad you want it. I mean, just check out that movie, The Pursuit of Happiness. And that's based on a true story that Will Smith was the lead character in. And I mean, that guy wanted that career in securities, right?
My thought went to The Founder.
Oh, yeah.
Like, man's a horrible man, but man, he wanted to rule.
He wanted McDonald's.
I'm going to say the opposite. Night. I'm going to argue with you, push back a little bit on this because it's the American Idol situation. All those people say they want it. Their dream is to be the American Idol and to sing well. And then they get up there and they can't sing. And a certain amount of, no matter how much you want it, I hate to say it, that this is a career that requires a certain level of ability and a certain level of luck. And everybody's not going to have that. And
but if you
there's
have
nothing
that,
worse than there's nothing worse than the C student, in my opinion, because the F student is nowhere close. They're easy to get rid of. The A student gets work. It's the C student who's not as
how much hard work is the factor. If there's all these little metrics, you're saying there's a talent, a certain level of proficiency that what I'm hearing you saying is you're born with it or you're not.
So there's an element of that after teaching for so long, I don't know if you can get around it. The kids that had it, I could teach and they went on and did great. The kids that didn't have it, they never got it. They got better, but they didn't get pro level.
Have you ever met a student that just worked their butts off and still couldn't get there?
Oh.
Like just really worked hard.
I have. I've seen both ways though. I've seen somebody who was really bad early and just dedicatedly did every assignment. This is amazing. This one student who did every assignment, even the most basic ones that everybody's kind of poo-pooing on because they're boring. I mean, he's really focused on them. And slowly but surely, he got so much better. And by the time he graduated, he was pro level, went on to work in video games, and he was fantastic. But for every one of him, I see 5 to 10 other people who they want it, and they just... They're not going
to, you know what
they're
seems
not gonna,
to
it be, doesn't mean you, it doesn't mean you don't have to, you can't get better. It doesn't mean that. It just means you might not be a pro.
You know what I think is the difference there? Cause I've seen that a lot too. The ones that work hard and don't ever get there, they seem to have a couple of things working against them. One, they don't look at what people are doing. They won't study people that are really successful. So there's one, they also seem to be a little close-minded when you give them advice.
That's true.
But the ones that are sponges, that are open-minded and just tell me what to do and I'll do it. Mm-hmm. And then they're also looking and they're actively looking on Instagram at good art. And then there's the person who you ask them who their heroes are and they show you really bad artists and you're like, that's the problem right there too. So it's like maybe it's the aesthetic. Maybe it's the aesthetic that they're born with or not born with, that they have or don't have. Because I mean, if you like things that no one likes, that's ugly, you're going to make ugly. You know what I mean?
I think there's a couple factors too. It's style, but it's also voice. And you may technically not be a great illustrator, but looking at your illustrations, you can see, this person's trying to say something interesting, something engaging, something,
smart,
smart or something
disturbing.
Like that. And that can take it 100 miles further than just the art. And I think of Strange Planet, the alien drawings. I don't know if you've seen that. The guy has 80 million Instagram followers, but the drawings are fine. They're passable, but the words that these aliens are saying, his outlook, his view is brilliant. And that's what has done so well. And I put him in the same camp as Gary Larson with The Far Side. You look at those drawings minus the gags and he's a C student, right?
Yeah.
I mean, eventually after doing it for 10 years or whatever, he really nailed down an interesting style, but it was more the joke than it was the art, right? And
that's where the smart comes in, I think.
Yeah. And then same with was it the oatmeal too?
Yeah. Daniel Inman, Matthew Inman.
If you really have a good voice, regardless if you do children's books or comics or anything, that could be a larger factor to your success than actual drawing ability. So you got to check your whole package and see like, what am I offering here? What are my abilities here? And what can I run with?
Yeah. If you're middle-aged, the question isn't your age. It's what can you make what can you make that will change people emotionally? Cause that's really the thing, you know, can you create art that solves interesting problems?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Then yes, you can.
And so the one thing you're going to have to get at that stage, especially if you're starting a little bit later, is a good mentor or a good sounding board. I mean, you need honest feedback, I guess is what I'm saying, as you start to navigate all this stuff, drawing and style and all that. So I guess at any stage of your career, you're really going to need that. We did a podcast on finding a mentor. Yeah. You might want to check out if you haven't heard it before.
Cool. Well, should we wrap it up?
Let's wrap it. Let's put it in a burrito.
Thanks for joining us, everybody. 3-Point Perspective is made possible by svslearn.com, where you can become a great illustrator. I don't know if great one, but you can become an illustrator. <It's> up, we'll teach you how to do it. It's up to you how great you'll be. But your hosts today have been Will Terry, Lee White, and I'm Jake Parker. And if you want to follow us on Instagram, our accounts are at Will Terry Art. So at Will Terry Art on Instagram. Lee is at Lee White Illo, and I am at Jake Parker. And then our podcast is produced by Daniel Tu, and you can find his work at daniel2.co, and Tu is spelled T-U. Special thanks to our SVS production manager, David Broad. And a thank you shout out to our social media specialist, Lisa Fott. If you liked this episode, hopefully you made it to the end. We appreciate that. If you like it, please share it around. Podcasts, they live and die by word of mouth. And so we'd love it if you gave it a review, tweeted about it, just pass it along to a friend. And also go on to our forum at svslearn.com. We have a thread devoted just to this particular episode. And you can pipe in over there if you think we're off the mark on something, or you think you've got a different answer. We'd love to hear what you think over at the forum. It's free to join. It's a great community going on there. Lots of nice people. So join us there and check it out. All right. I think that's it. Thanks, everybody. We'll see you next time.